Happy Thursday morning. You are on The Third Degree with Simon Unwin for a half hour of environment and social justice discussion. You are, of course, tuned to 2SER FM. On the show today, the UN cautions Australia on industrial development near the Great Barrier Reef, the federal government looking to give away some of its environmental powers to the states, and we look at managing e-waste in the Pacific. First today, the Great Barrier Reef World Heritage Area may be formally listed as in danger if there's not more done to protect it from industrial development. That's the warning in a report from UNESCO's World Heritage Committee released last week. Now, it sparked something of a standoff between the federal government and the Queensland government over mining and export developments along the reef's coast, with Environment Minister Tony Burke delaying federal approval for the massive Alpha coal mine nearby. And there's already been community anger in Queensland that part of the World Heritage Area in Gladstone Harbour is being dredged for an expansion of a shipping channel. So I spoke yesterday to Queensland Friends of the Earth campaigner Derek Davies.
Earlier this year in January, the World Heritage Committee sent a representative over and did a monitoring mission all up the Queensland coast, talking with stakeholders and having a look at the reef and the impacts from mining and industry, and that report hasn't been released yet, and we can expect that later this month.
Yeah, now while that mission was over here, a couple of actions occurred in Queensland. What was that action, and what was that trying to draw attention to?
We had a Gladstone local, Mark Driscoll, paddle his way out into the reef, into Gladstone Harbour, and chain himself onto one of the dredges there, and that was a fantastic action. But more importantly, what we had is a 71-year-old grandmother from Brisbane walk from out where the coal and the gas development is in the Darling Downs and Wandoan around the mine there, and walked all the way to Gladstone, 500 kilometres. It took her a month to raise attention, and she met with the World Heritage Committee representative and shared the stories of the communities all the way through the journey about their concerns over coal mining and coal seam gas development in Queensland.
At the moment, that fairly rapid pace of development of coal and coal seam gas in Queensland is meaning that Gladstone Harbour is going to see a lot more traffic. What's been happening in and around Gladstone Harbour there?
In Gladstone Harbour, we have mass development at the moment, Simon. I think your listeners would be really shocked to hear is that for the last 8 months, we've had 24/7 dredging within the Great Barrier Reef to allow bigger boats to get in and out of both coal ports and the new coal seam gas LNG ports in Gladstone. There's four of these things being built, not one. Companies haven't talked to each other. They haven't sort of joined forces and built one plant. They've decided to build four. And so that means massive dredging. It's destroyed acres and acres of precious seagrasses. So we've got dugongs at risk. We've had 200 or so dugongs wash up dead in the Great Barrier Reef in the last year. And what we see also happening is 40 kilometres north of Gladstone, we have a new area that the Queensland state government is looking at developing and destroying, Balaclava Island. Now, this area is the home of Australia's only and highly endangered snubfin dolphin. And north of there, we see one of Australia's only, what we could claim to be a delta system. So this is where rivers join into the Great Barrier Reef. And in high tides, this area is just flooded for kilometres inland. And then when the tide's out, it's just snaking with creeks and mud flats and river systems. And it's home to our beautiful and wonderful. And what we have is some big companies wanting to build two new coal ports there. So Balaclava Island and another one called the Fitzroy Delta Project. And this is all in the Fitzroy River Delta system, and it is shocking. And the state government is really pressing ahead with development at the moment. We have great concern.
Queensland's Premier Campbell Newman has been quite upfront about being very, very much pro-development with all of these ports and new coal and coal seam gas projects, saying that Queensland is in the coal business. The agenda for this next meeting for the World Heritage Centre is actually recommending that no new port development or associated infrastructure is established outside of the already established areas. How likely is the Queensland government to heed that recommendation, do you think?
We're not sure, to tell you the truth. The situation is that the Australian government is the signatory to the World Heritage Convention. And obviously then the state government needs to heed that position. You've seen being played out in the media at the moment and Tony Burke saying it will remove decision-making powers from the state. And now if that happens, it is a control mechanism to put really the measures to protect the Great Barrier Reef solely in the hands of the federal government, which it has legislated in its powers now. So we can see that if the Queensland government try to move ahead with these developments, it's going to hit a brick wall with the Commonwealth, and we welcome that. But what the meeting last year in July of the World Heritage Committee, it set the tone, and it gave a message clearly to the Australian government that it notes with extreme concern that there's development in the Great Barrier Reef that it wasn't aware of and that it wasn't approving. And so now, a year later, we've had the World Heritage Committee come to Australia, do an assessment and make a request to the Australian government to formulate and move ahead with what's called a strategic assessment. So this is under Commonwealth legislation. And the Commonwealth and the state are working in partnership to do that. But obviously they're not agreeing on the terms of reference, they're not agreeing on the way forward, and we see this stoush being played out in the media. And we welcome this because we see that, you know, the Queensland economy and with the Campbell Newman coming out saying we're in the business of coal, and clearly there's lack of vision happening within the state at the moment. There is no way that they're able to move forward on economic development. We're tied to this dirty coal industry and dirty energy when we should be looking at into the future and looking at, well, what type of renewable energy can we develop? What type of technology can we build, our skill base, and how do we export that to the world? But instead, we're still looking at dirty old fossil fuels. It's a worry.
One of the outcomes the World Heritage Centre have pointed to, if there's not more oversight or more decisive action taken to protect the reef, they're indicating that the Great Barrier Reef World Heritage Area could be declared to be in danger next year. Now, what would be the significance of that?
Australia is a leader in many areas of looking at conservation. We seek to protect whales, and we're signatories to so many conventions, and we're really out there, our Australian government and, you know, backed by the nation, to lead some of this push. To have then it to be seen that we'd failed to protect the largest marine ecosystem in the world from dirty energy export development would be a huge shame, and shame to the Australian government. And what we'd see then is that tourism here, because word would get around, tourist operators are proud promoters that we have a World Heritage Area. The economy, billions of dollars every year into the Queensland and Australian economy and tourism, will slowly shrink and be lost over time, because with 10,000 coal ships and gas ships moving in and out through the reef and countless new mines and port developments all sprinkled up the coastline, we'll see a real impact to the workers and small business and tourist outlets in Queensland. So it's a bit of a flow-on effect, and we really hope that the World Heritage Committee can stick to its guns and really push the pressure onto the Australian government and then onto the Queensland government.
That's Derek Davies of Friends of the Earth Queensland speaking to me yesterday. So we did have World Environment Day earlier this week, an event marked in Australia by environmental NGOs criticising planned changes to federal environment laws. Now, these changes would see many environmental assessments, which are currently determined by the federal government, become the responsibility of the states and territories. So concerned about what that will mean for environmental protections here, these environmental groups held a national summit on the issue in Canberra last month. Denise Boyd, who's the campaigns director with the Australian Conservation Foundation, is speaking here with Third Degree's Jessica Minchell.
So Australia's environment groups have a variety of interests, and we will from time to time come together to discuss matters of common interest or importance. However, this meeting was pulled together very quickly and is an expression of the high level of concern and anxiety that is felt across the environmental sector about this proposal to fast-track development, not just in areas of national environmental importance, but in our towns and cities. Because what this actually means is that developments will be fast-tracked and that issues that were of concern to communities, for example, Traveston Dam, or additional conditions that were placed on a proposed pulp mill development in Tasmania, those issues would be delegated to the states to make decisions. Can you imagine what would happen if a state government was able to sanction, for example, drilling on the Great Barrier Reef or mining in the Kimberley, and to effectively tick off on those sorts of proposals in areas where all Australians feel an attachment to without federal oversight? That would be acting in the state's interest, because the states have an interest in bringing development into their region, and that's right and proper. However, there needs to be checks and balances. That's why we have national environmental laws, and that's why we need to strengthen them, not wind them back. We cannot give states the responsibility for assessing large-scale projects, because they are often the beneficiaries of those projects and may indeed even be the proponents of them. That's why our national environment laws are in place, to look after our environment, to protect our national icons.
The main changes focus around the Environment Protection and Diversity Act, which deals with environmental matters of national significance. Mm-hmm. What are the main protections provided by this act in its current form?
These environmental laws, they protect our land, they protect our wildlife, and they make sure that our air and our water aren't polluted by inappropriate development. But also it speaks to our responsibility to protect our natural places. And sometimes development in particular areas is inappropriate because it can have either a direct impact on that particular area, or it can have an impact further away from where that development is taking place.
After the state government's COAG meeting in April, it was announced that after having listened to concern from business groups, there would be reforms for environmental assessments and development approvals. What impact will this cutting of red tape or green tape in order to streamline processes actually have?
What big business has done is that they've convinced our national government to wind back environmental protections by allowing the state governments to actually have the final say on more development proposals. Now, our response is that we know that this will not work. Nationally significant environmental assets do need national level protection, and we know from long experience that state governments don't assess development proposals with the national interest in mind. We've just seen a recent example of that with the federal environment minister now stopping the clock on a mining development in Queensland. What we're concerned about is that this isn't just an attack on the environment, it's actually an attack on democracy. So business and industry are successfully lobbying behind closed doors to wind back and weaken our national environmental laws. We need stronger laws, not weaker ones. So that's why we're asking that the government actually reject this, the amendments that are being proposed for the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. That's our national legislative instrument. We want that to be rejected.
Is this likely to lead to improvements or at least standardisation across the states and territories' separate environmental regulation processes at the moment?
Look, we're always going to need to have national oversight of development and major projects. And that's because decisions need to be taken in the national interest, not in the state interest. I think there's definitely an argument for bringing the level of development assessment across the board and at all state and territory level up to an agreed national standard. We should be aiming for best practice, not for a race to the bottom in order to speed up development. We need to get the balance right because there are other industries in this country that rely on clean air, clean water and a healthy environment.
And that was Denise Boyd from the Australian Conservation Foundation speaking to Jessica Minchell yesterday. New Zealand band Opossum with Getaway Tonight. Great track. You are listening to The Third Degree on 2SER. I'm Simon Unwin. And for our final story this week, a new national e-waste scheme will start up in July. And in the lead up to that, we're having a series of stories on electronic waste here on The Third Degree. E-waste is still being illegally shipped out of Australia, contributing to the growing problem of e-waste dumping worldwide. A few weeks ago, you would have heard us speaking with Tatiana Terakova of the United Nations Environment Programme. Today, we're changing geographical focus, spotlighting on our near neighbours, Pacific Island nations. Now, David Haynes is the Director of Waste Management and Pollution Control with the Secretariat of the Pacific Regional Environment Programme. And he's here speaking with the Third Degree's Jessica Minchell.
At this stage, there's actually not a lot of management going on. As Pacific Island countries move into the 21st century, there's obviously a growing reliance on electronic and electrical goods. And we're in a phase now where these sorts of products are accumulating on islands and they're starting to wear out, and we need to plan for their environmentally friendly disposal, I guess is the best way of putting it.
So what has been the policies by most of the governments in the Pacific in terms of dealing with that e-waste? Has it mainly gone to landfill?
Yeah, typically that's how it's disposed of, or in worst cases, being dumped on beaches or in the ocean, that kind of thing. So here at SPREP, we've published a regional strategy and action plan to deal with the issue. That plan hopefully will be endorsed by our member countries over the next 6 months, and that sets out some very clear guidance and I guess agendas to better manage e-waste into the future.
And what are the main issues that are outlined in that plan?
Always critical is the issue around funding. Typically, as a product is bought, be it a washing machine or a refrigerator or a computer, there's no import tax placed on that product that can be held to use for its disposal. So one of the things we're advocating on is a cradle to grave philosophy, so that when a consumer buys the equipment, they pay an upfront fee which can be held in trust, and then that fee can be accessed at a later date to environmentally or dispose of the product in an environmentally friendly manner.
Where else is a policy like that in place? Because that's not standard even here in Australia, I believe.
No, there's been a lot of talk about this kind of scheme over the last 10 years in Europe, America and Australia, but no one has yet effectively enforced it, I guess. I think the advantage that we have here in the Pacific is that typically the movement of these products is much smaller. They have to come in as an import simply because they're not manufactured here, so that potentially allows us a lot more control over them and tracking of them as they come in and then are disposed of.
Australia has had issues with illegal shipments of e-waste being sent out of Australia to places such as China. Do you see as the issue with dealing with electronic waste in the Pacific as individual dumpings into the ocean rather than collected shipments out of countries?
At the moment, to my knowledge, there's only been three disposals of e-waste in the Pacific, and they have been to Singapore and to Australia. So when a country in the Pacific exports this kind of waste material, they have to conform with the Waigani Convention, which is a regional convention. The reason for the convention being in place is that the exporter has to nominate where the product is going to end up, and then that's assessed by the local officials, and it has to be an environmentally friendly solution for its disposal or it can't be exported. And similarly, Australia at the other end, or New Zealand for that matter, are both signatories to the convention, so they're keeping their eye on it as well.
Can you speak a little bit more about the Waigani Convention and what restrictions it places on Pacific Island nations when dealing with e-waste, as well as how it sits with the Basel Convention in specific regard to Pacific Island nations?
The Waigani Convention is essentially the sister convention to the Basel Convention. The only difference with it is that the Waigani Convention also deals with nuclear waste, whereas the Basel Convention doesn't. And that's actually why it was first implemented, because of the potential for problems in the Pacific with nuclear waste disposal. So basically, both conventions are written to ensure that when a hazardous waste is exported, there needs to be an authority at the exporting end that can vouch for where the waste has been, where it's come from, and then it also has to have a nominated receiver of that waste. And if those two things aren't in the convention, it's illegal to transport the material around the Pacific or into Australia or New Zealand.
Is it mainly space restraints, or what are the particular challenges that Pacific Island nations face with the problem of e-waste?
Well, I guess there's two issues. One is certainly space is an issue, but ideally this sort of material should be disposed of in an environmentally sensitive manner. Dumping it in a landfill is not that. And if we can get the e-waste exported to a country that can then probably on-ship it to a country that has specific plant that can then handle the e-waste and retrieve the particularly heavy metals and other valuable commodities from it in an environmentally sustainable manner, that's clearly the way we want to go.
You mentioned before that SPREP has put together some guidelines for how Pacific Island nations can manage their e-waste. Can you speak a little bit more about what SPREP's role is in helping the different countries manage their e-waste more effectively?
Well, I guess we've done a couple of things to date. The first one, of course, is to draft the regional strategy, which, as I mentioned before, we hope will be signed off by member countries in the next 6 months. And that's a comprehensive plan for management of e-waste in the Pacific. We also have a new publication, which is an awareness-raising tool for journalists in particular. And the third thing that we've done is we've been really aggressive in trying to secure additional funding in the region for disposal and management of e-waste. And we currently have around a $200,000 US SICAM grant at the moment that will be used in Kiribati, Samoa and the Cook Islands to manage e-waste.
And that's David Haynes from the Secretariat of the Pacific Regional Environment Program, speaking with the Third Degree's Jessica Minchell. That is all we have time for on the show this week. You're listening to 2SER. Stay tuned for The Daily coming up next. ¶¶